Hello everybody and welcome back to Discerning Consciousness. I'm your host Ant-Man, it's delighted to have you all on board again. And today is an exciting development on the show. I'm actually on location with Heather, who's been joining me recently to do some episodes on shamanism. And we're delighted to welcome our special guest, Peter Knight. It's great to have you here, Peter. And we're actually at the Stone Circle at Avebury, of all places. And it's a sunny day, believe it or not, here in the south, in the Wiltshire countryside. And so during the recording, you may well hear different noises, and right on cue, I think that's a small plane that's flying overhead. And obviously the voices of people passing by. Hope you appreciate that this is our first attempt at a recording on location, so to speak.
Hello, Ant.
Hello, Heather.
Back again. Nice to be with you. And lovely to welcome Peter. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Heather.
I hope you're as excited as we are to have you on our show. And like Ant says, all sorts of weird noises going around with us. But let's face it, this is a basis in shamanism. And shamanism is being out in the landscape, mm-hmm. It's being out in nature, and it's being out within our country, often many people, and all sorts of activity going on, which is part of the fun.
It is.
Yeah. Thank you very much for joining us, Peter. I'd really like to first say that Peter, I would consider personally as one of our country's experts mm-hmm. on the land. I would say of the ley lines, mm-hmm. stone circles, sacred site, all over our country. And I think if our listeners looked at his list of books that are on the market now, I think they can get them in just about every bookshop. Is that right, Peter?
Yes, you certainly can, or
yeah,
direct from my website
or Amazon.
Or on Amazon, yeah,
definitely. Yeah. A whole list of books that we'll come to later shows Peter to be very in touch with the land, shows Peter to be very knowledgeable alongside some of our famous what would you call geologists? Geomancers? What would you call them, Peter? What would you call yourself?
The weird and wonderful, really, yes.
All of the above.
All of the above and more, yes, yeah.
I'd just like to say also that we're here with Peter's partner, Sue. She sat with us.
Hi, Sue.
Just say hello, Sue. She's enjoying the sunshine with us today and come along, so we wouldn't leave you out.
Thank you.
Really nice for you to be here too.
Thank you.
Peter, the thing that I remember about your involvement, very much so, is the full moon drumming. Now, I think you've been doing full moon drumming for quite some time, haven't you?
Yes, about 15 years, I would say. Yes, we go up to West Kennet Longbow on the full moons when they occur on Friday, Saturday or Sunday, because we find that's when people can most mm-hmm. make it. And we have some very sacred occasions up there because I'm a great believer that we should use these sites today. They're not just relics and, of bygone ages. And they've survived for today. Perhaps the ancestors knew they would survive a few thousand years and that they'd be there for us to use again perhaps when the time was needed mm-hmm. or our consciousness came round again after 2,000 years of fake news. I love to take people out in the open into the landscape, because how can you contact the landscape through books? You can't. You've got to get out there on the landscape. You've got to go to the place of ancestors, and perhaps I try and get people to experience on our days and our evenings and our weekend workshops, perhaps a taste of what people were doing there, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's like stepping in the TARDIS, really. We take them up a hill into the middle of nowhere, and if they're lucky, we'll bring them back again. And if they're really nice, and we give them a taste of sort of what everybody was doing up there. What we call shamanism today. An earth consciousness. I think everybody had that consciousness automatically thousands of years ago. You were brought up to, to have that consciousness as a child, just like the Aboriginal cultures of today do.
And being totally in touch with the reality of the spirits of the land, the spirits of all forms of life, and the spirits of the past, or shall I say the ancestors? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because the spirits of the past, of course, are all around us. You know, time is an illusion, and the basis of shamanism is that you can go from one dimension to the other, and that time doesn't really exist, you know. It's all something we've invented to make sense of the universe, really. So I think you can quite easily, at places like West Kennet, get into an altered state and get your mind out of the way, really. You know, get Brexit out of the way, get Donald Trump out of the way, and try to focus on
things. National Trust.
Yes, yes, and focus on voting green and all those sort of screens. So it's a way of just seeing life, experiencing life, how it really is, not how we've been led to believe it is. Mm. It's a big difference.
And from what you said just a few sentences back, then one should not take any notice of your great array of books. Don't do it through books, you say.
Don't do it through books unless they're mine.
Unless
is, well, yes. All of my books have a chapter at the end, usually, on trying to get people out onto the land. And I do say you can't get it through books. Books can inspire us. I'm a great believer in books. You know, because God, how many books have I got?
Sue? Hundreds.
Yeah,
hundreds.
She's grimacing
hundreds
at this point. Yeah. And, but yeah, I don't
groaning
think.
Bookshop.
And there is a sign actually that books are making a comeback, aren't they? Which is good.
Well, Kindle's on the decline, apparently.
Yes.
So.
Yeah.
Seriously, I'm really
yeah
pleased to hear
yeah
that. I have
people
to say.
Need, people need you know some tactile stuff in their life. They need touchy feely and all that sort of thing. And hopefully, as we get in touch with touching and feeling nature again, then books will come back to a certain extent. Yeah.
I remember many years ago, Peter, before I met you, that a crowd that I was with on a particular Sunday afternoon all decided to take a trip to Knowlton in Dorset. And somebody had your first book, Sacred Dorset, would that be?
Ancient Stones of Dorset, and Dorset. Then Sacred Ancient Dorset was the second
ah
book.
Ah, right, okay, so we had the early one, I think,
right,
which somebody had it clasped in their hand and was reading it out to us and informing us of all the information surrounding and Knowlton. Very informative, very interesting.
Well, it was
an enlightened day.
I love it when you say that, because that's what I want people to do, to take the books out onto the landscape.
There you go.
You know, when I did the novel 13 Moons, several people have got back to me saying, oh, we've gone to all the sites and we've read that chapter actually standing at the site that it describes, and oh, it's just like you said. And I said, yes, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
I was sitting there making the notes. So
I'm going to say something I think is profound, but I mean, I know it's a bit silly in a way, but would you say then that the books are like gateways?
Definitely.
Would you describe your books as gateways to the land?
Yeah, any book is a gateway to that subject. But yes, I think so. I think, they can be an introduction to something that'll hopefully turn on a button, turn on a light switch, you know. I've had some lovely comments from people who have said, God, you know, your book has changed my life.
Yeah.
You know, it's sent me down a totally different path, just like books I have written me down a certain path, you know, going right back 20 years, you know, Louise Hay, Shakti Garway, and all those sort of things. And they just turn your light on, and all of a sudden, whoa, there's more to life than all this crap we've been fed. And so I feel really humble, actually, because it's not my wisdom, it's not my knowledge, it's the ancient knowledge.
Mm.
You know, people like me are just the messenger, really, just like you are.
Yes, yeah. And as we're standing, well, we're standing right next to a particular stone here at Avebury, I wonder if you could just tell our listeners a little bit of a potted history about the stone circle here at Avebury.
Well, it's the biggest stone circle in the world. It's one of the few things that we have in Britain that they don't have a bigger one of in the States.
Oh, right.
And
it's reassuring.
Yes, it is very reassuring, yeah. So it's made up of an outer circle, originally of 98 stones, and two inner circles, the sun circle, the moon circle. Lots of astronomy, lots of sacred geometry.
Yeah.
You know, all this was worked out between, you know, 3,000 and 4,000 years ago. So that's when astronomy really began.
Mm-hmm.
So the solstice alignments, lunar alignments here. And it's also almost exactly in the centre of the famous St. Michael line.
Right.
Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst did a book, The Sun and the Serpent, many years ago, telling how the stretch of the rainbow serpent that goes around the planet, the stretch that goes across Britain, they call the St. Michael line. Because you know, all the St. Michael sites along it, and it's aligned with the Beltane or the Lugnasad sunrise. So twice a year, the sun shines right down the line at successively different sites as you go down the line from East Anglia to Cornwall. And Avery is almost exactly in the middle of that.
Right.
And the energies mingle and merge, and you can douse the energies here as they pass through the site for about 500 metres. Mm-hmm. And then they go on their way across the landscape again. So the ancestors knew exactly where to put Avery to access these energies, which are like the life force of Mother Earth. They're the mm-hmm. serpents of all the ancient cultures. You know, when you get your dowsing rod out, you're dowsing serpents, you're dowsing dragons. You know, these are the dragon lines.
And would you say a lot of the iconography around that is repeated in all different cultures across the world? You see the same kind of iconography?
Yeah, stone circles are on every continent, you know, just like dolmens are on every continent and stone rows. You know, all around the world, there was this urge during the Neolithic to suddenly erect standing stones. I think it came in with farming, of course. Where before that, in the hunter-gatherer days, people were moving around. Mm-hmm. You know, they were never in one place. But once farming swept across the world over just a few centuries, you're now in one place, and now you can put up the burial tombs for the ancestors to live in. You're not just leaving them where they drop.
Sure.
You know, and so therefore you've got a place where you can commune with the ancestors 24/7, any time you like. And they also found soon, I think, as soon as you put stones in the ground, you're amplifying the energy. You know, they're like acupuncture needles going into the ground.
Sure.
And of course it amplifies the energy. You know where it's going to be. You put a stone circle in the ground on an energy line, you know that energy line is always going to be there. Mm-hmm. It's like they're putting a tent peg in the ground, you know, to pin it down.
Mm. So, you had a photograph from a member of the public once, did you not? Where they had a certain type of camera that showed sort of like the ley filter line here in...
Harry Oldfield's filter, his wonderful filter, controversial.
Harry Oldfield's filter?
Filter, yes.
Oh, right, okay. And it went up over one
over
of...
Over two people, yeah.
Over the two people, because they were near...
Sue Murray, I think, was one of them.
There was two people, wasn't there? There was two
and in the shot. Sandy McKenzie was one of the other ones. Nice American lady.
Right. And, that's Sue Murray's friend?
Yeah.
Ah, oh, yes, I've heard of her, yeah.
But anyway, yes, you can get certain filters to see these energies controversially, but some people can see them in their mind's eye anyway. We've got a few friends who you can just, and I've had a sensation of just looking across the landscape, and you can just see the bright light or the rainbows coming across. You know, it's all around us. Just
would you say that was because you've put a great deal of concentration into following the ley lines, to researching the land and the sacred sites, the energy sites, etc., that little by little your sight is opening up to those vibrations?
I think there's a certain amount in that for sure, yeah.
Do you think, were you doing it before you took a great interest?
No, I wasn't. No, so I think you can attune, I think a lot of it is about just, you know, getting rid of disbelief. You know, if, you need to believe in anything to experience it generally, or it helps. But yes, I think the more time you spend at sacred sites, you're kind of tuning into the land, into the energy. I found my sensitivities have opened the more I spent time at sacred sites.
Yes.
Definitely.
Yeah. And do you find this happens to people that participate in your workshops?
That's the plan. And I think by the end of the weekend, it does for all of them. But, you know, there's not an agenda really, because everybody who comes to a stone circle or, you know, on our Dartmoor weekends, there isn't an agenda to make them all experience the same thing. Because that would be a failure, in my opinion, because our experience of the landscape and planet Earth is unique for all of us.
Of course.
Because that is why we're all here. You know, planet Earth doesn't want us to all experience the same things, because... Mm. She is seeking to know herself, and we are a facet of that. Mm. So she wants our individuality, as far as I'm concerned, not to us all think the same.
I hope that doesn't include destruction.
Destruction.
Destruction of parts of Mother Earth.
Oh, distraction.
Destruction.
Destruction. No, certainly not. No.
So or to be devil's advocate, wouldn't that be Mother Earth also experiencing the more negative side, as we would call it?
It is. There is the dark and there is the light, of course. But the thing is, when I look around nature, all nature strives to do is create balance. Mm. That's its remit. That's planet Earth's remit, really, on a physical level. because there's nowhere do you not see balance in nature unless man
has become involved. Normally for profit.
So, you know, what man is doing isn't a natural process, really, but we've been given free will. It's really funny that this thing that Christianity holds up is that God has given us free will. Is actually true, but I would say goddess, but it's the same thing. I
think very contemporary of you there, Peter.
I think the planet Earth is let us loose, and she's been a very patient mother up to now. Perhaps she's just waiting to see whether the light can come out of the dark. She's been a very patient mother with her naughty children, really, but I'm wondering for how much longer, be honest.
Are you of the mindset of that no matter what we do, she can end up swallowing up the human race all over again,
of
no trouble?
Of course she will. There's been several mass extinctions in the past.
Yeah.
And after every mass extinction, life is always more prolific after the mass extinction than it was before. Wow. Always. There's always more
life. For new
life.
Growth, things have to die back.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I've been saying for years, we're not fighting to save the planet. As an environmentalist, I'm not fighting to save the planet, really. I'm trying to slow down the processes, perhaps, so that planet Earth, that nature has a chance to adapt. Mm. Because even if some people argue this is a natural cycle, some idiots like Donald Trump, you know, this is just a natural cycle. You know, mankind isn't having an influence on the planet negatively. But okay, playing devil's advocate, even if that is true, and it is a natural cycle, perhaps between the glacials, we are still making it happen quicker than it should do. So therefore, we are having a negative influence because nature isn't having time to adapt.
Would you say then that nature could be trying to cleanse the part of the whole system that is making fast changes, for instance, humans? I mean, we're a facet of the whole of nature, but we've got it fixed that it's us against Mother Earth.
I mean, you look at it like if I get a cold or a virus, okay, that's a natural thing that's come into my body, but eventually my body will decide, okay, that's enough, and it'll get rid of it. Because that virus, once my body has learned how to cope with that and remembers it, doesn't need that lesson anymore. And I'm wondering whether that's kind of similar.
It tucks it away, doesn't it?
It tucks it away, yeah.
And disables it.
Yeah.
Do you think that's what will happen to human beings, or mammals, shall I say?
I really don't know. I don't have a lot of hope. I mean, I'm a very positive person, but I don't see how so many people can live on this planet. That's it. That's the sentence, actually. they can't. Even if we don't have a single baby, if everybody on this planet doesn't have a single baby, it's still not enough. It's still not enough. There's still not enough food to go around. The UN worked out a few years ago in a study that no matter which scenario you use, mankind cannot feed itself in just 50 years' time. So we're all going to be starving in 50 years, no matter what happens.
Right.
The Earth has to do something to cope. You could even say it's the love of the planet. You know, sometimes there's a lot of environmental programs where a few deer have to be culled or a few ponies have to be culled for the herd to survive, for the species to survive. You see it all the time now.
Does that quite naturally anyway.
Nature does that naturally, you see. But the trouble is, nature selects the weak animals to go, so therefore the species, the strong ones, are the ones, like Charles Darwin said, are the only ones that to survive. But the trouble is, why we're out of kilter, because we've got too good at keeping people alive who shouldn't be alive. I'm not on about euthanasia or anything like that.
No, this is obviously it's and discussions around this topic have to be done in a very delicate way, because people can misinterpret what you know.
That's right. I mean, if you go back just several generations, people weren't living beyond 60. That is the natural lifespan of the human being. And
Ninety plus is quite common now, isn't it?
But it's also very common.
But also, we've got a mass increase throughout the world, haven't we? Literally, the world.
Oh, it's a
mass
whole world
increase.
Over. Yeah, yeah. We're very good at staying alive because of farming. As soon as we invented farming a few thousand years ago, that put us above nature. So we thought. Because, in ancient times, in the Neolithic or the Bronze Age, if there was a bad winter, you know, your tribe probably wouldn't survive, but of course, once farming came in, you could store food then, so it didn't matter how bad the winter was, you've got loads of grain stored away. So of course people, the death rate plummeted. So it's a problem that I don't have the answer to, really, because I'm not sure there is an answer.
Do you not think this is new to the human race? No matter how many cataclysms there's been in the past and nearly wiping out the human race, shall we say, which is a belief rather than myth. Do you not think that we could be now, is it all about narrowing the human race, making it narrow again?
I don't see any sign of that, do you? I don't see any sign of that.
The
whole of medicine and science is designed to keep people living even longer.
Yes. As we know, no matter how many medical solutions come about, then nature seems to bring about yet another ill of some sort to counterbalance.
That's right. All the antibiotics now, they're saying, are almost defunct.
Yes.
Because nature's finding a way around them.
Yes.
So I don't know, you could look at that as planet Earth intervening.
Yeah.
You know, planet Earth is producing, you know, to trying to restore balance, in effect.
Mm.
You know, and the only way you can do that is to keep overriding the things we invent to survive.
Mm.
It sounds to me like you have a passion to bring this knowledge to the population, shall we say. I was wondering, when you do your workshops, for instance on Dartmoor, is this the type of opening to people's awarenesses that you're hoping that people experience?
I don't really talk about religious or environmental ethics when we take people out, because I find by the end of the weekend they're discussing those anyway.
Okay.
It's about turning a person, because when you, the idea is to take people out and purely and simply to get them to regard the land as sacred and to interact with the land in a profound way. And really that's all you have to do, because once you do that, people as a natural consequence of that will start regarding the earth as sacred, and that affects their whole lifestyle, whether they go green, whether they go vegetarian, you know, whether they drive a smaller car, because it opens up the doorway for them to speak about, you know, to think about other things. So I think as a consequence of connecting to the landscape sacredly, then you start reading books about the Native Americans, about the Aborigines, and that changes your life anyway. So I like to keep it really simple. All our workshops are accessible. They're not intellectual things.
No.
You know, they're just about taking people out on the land, showing them the Simulacra in the rocks, getting them to walk the stone rows, getting them to walk around this stone circle, and just to perhaps look at things slightly differently than they have before.
I remember walking around the stone circle with you quite a long time ago, in Avery here, and you showed me a view on the stones. Although I'd been looking at it several times in the past, you showed me particularly, I think you were talking about a torchlight at night time to shine on the stones, and seeing it as the ancestors saw it and understanding therefore their purpose. And it transported me right back, I think, thousands of years to an understanding that really just, I have, sorry the cliche, but blew me away. Do you still do these tours?
Yeah, every April and October we take people around on torchlit walks around Avery, because that's when the nights are getting...
April, know, and what? Could you repeat
October.
That? October. Oh, so October's coming up,
When the nights start drawing in a little bit, and we shine torches on the stones, and the faces come out of you, just literally, that you wouldn't have noticed otherwise.
Yeah.
And we flicker the torches to replicate naked flames around the stones.
Yeah, it's marvellous.
And of course, a lot of people would have been looking at these images in the rocks or the stones at Avery, with a lot of hallucinogens in them, you know.
Of course, of course.
Those aren't on my tour.
Of course, not just magic mushroom.
I was interested until that point.
Oh no, sounds interesting to me.
Yes. So there were 15 species of psychoactive mushroom growing in southern England.
Ergo, ergot was one of them.
Yeah, magic mushrooms, henbane.
Mushroom.
The sort of things that are still around today.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all available to the people on Dartmoor or Stonehenge or Avery, and they'd have taken them with sleep deprivation, food deprivation, trance drumming. People would have gone into an altered state.
And there would have been experts that controlled this.
There always has to be someone who holds the space. Like you did for me in West Kennet and on the New Forest. You need somebody there who ensure they don't go totally bonkers. In fact, it's someone who's half bonkers, a bit like you, actually. That's what we need.
Now we're introducing Peter, the truth about me.
I'll have to put that on all your promo stuff in future. Yes. Half bonkers. Shamanka.
The shamans of old and still are today in some tribes are people who are regarded as schizophrenic or a bit odd. They don't special needs, we'd call them. So they see nowadays they have special needs. 1,000 years ago they'd have been a shaman. Yeah. You know, so it's the people who see things differently, a bit wacky. Wow. And of course they're alienated today. But they'd have been welcome as being just they had the eyes to see things a bit differently.
Related to that, obviously. A while back we were talking briefly about some of the problems that are caused by our inability to connect with the land and to see it as an integral part of who we are as human beings walking this planet. What was different about people during the Bronze Age or Neolithic era? What was different about their consciousness or the societies that they lived in that meant that they were, it was just more of an instinctive thing to connect with the land?
I think you've only got to look at the tribal cultures of today, of Central America, South America, the Native Americans, the Aborigines especially, because the Aborigines have the longest continuous, culture going back unimpeded, really.
Sure.
To see how people live close to the land and how they're regarded as sacred. You know, in the Aboriginal outback, you know, every large boulder, every weird-looking tree has a significance. It's all part of the Dreamtime. Mm-hmm. And in my new Dartmoor book, I say, well, look, all these big tors and mountains around Dartmoor, you know, and all the weird shapes in the rocks that you see, they were weird shapes thousands of years ago.
Sure, of course.
And across Native America today and around the world, really, rocks that resemble something like a face or an elephant or a bird are regarded as evidence that the spirit present, and spirit is manifesting as that form in the form that we will recognize, you know, because then it has cultural meaning. So I think we can apply that back here right across the world, really, because it's a continuous culture. We don't have to guess about it. And we've got cairns, we've got burial mounds, we've got stone circles here, just like they have in cultures elsewhere, where the natives are still going to those places, you know, medicine wheels in North America and that sort of thing. So we don't know. It's not pie in the sky, really. We can apply anthropological studies of the cultures today that have survived with little interference from man, and we can apply that back here in the pre-religious days.
Just for the listeners, could you just describe what you understand that is dream time according to how the Aboriginally understand dream time and what else?
Yeah, the original concept of dream time comes from people seeking to explain the world around them. Usually it involves a creation myth. And in my book, Stolen Images,
well remembered.
I look at where all the Christian symbols came from, and all the Christian symbols have a pagan origin. And the Christian book of Genesis, saying, you know, God created the earth and all that, is just the latest version of all the Dreamtime myths, which involve the creation myth, and usually ancestors or demigods or gods come down to the earth and create the landscape around them. And the idea of the dream start time is that you can see relics of this creation myth literally in the landscape all around you. Because the gods, God, the goddess, never left.
Yeah.
You know, the dream time and the creation just shows when those beings first came down to earth and created everything. And the Aborigines still see dream time as being all around them. They just have to go for a walk out into the landscape, and then they see rocks, they see the trees, they see the rivers as a serpent, you know, and all sorts of things. So you can quite... When we take people up onto Dartmoor and elsewhere, we get them in touch with the Dreamtime landscape, and by the end of the weekend, they are showing us faces in the rocks.
Sure.
You know, they are showing us the serpent in the river, and they are seeing ancestors around them, things that they've never done before. Mm-hmm. And all we've done is take them out and get all the clutter out of their mind, get all the phones out of the way, and all that stuff. And just get them to walk the landscape, because walking is so important. All the Aboriginal cultures have got sung lines, and they're where the elders take the initiates out.
What was that, sorry?
Sung lines. Oh. They've got the Aboriginal sung lines.
The equivalent of the ley lines, I guess,
sure,
over here,
yeah.
Where the elders take the initiates out onto the landscape and they tell them the myths as they're walking. They'll go to that boulder, the story,
yeah.
They'll go to that rock, tell the story, they'll go to that well, tell the next story, and it's a bit like beating the bounds over here, you
it's
know.
The Aztec lines, the glyphs?
Nazca lines.
Nazca lines, what I was trying to think of.
Yeah.
Would you say that that's what they were for? Because there seems to be a lot of not knowing, from what I've read, of the Nazca lines.
Well, the Nazca lines are meant to be seen from the air, aren't they? They're meant to be seen above, just like the white horses are, the ancient white horses and the Cern giant.
So wouldn't they have just been the walk lines?
Yeah, they could well be. I mean, the pictures to me, they're not pointing up for UFOs to see, as some people say. Oh, you can only see this Nazca line from a flying saucer. Well, actually, no, you can't. They're messages, perhaps, when the shaman's flying across the land, you know, and
yes.
Astral travel and that
yes.
sort of thing. But also, they are lines meant to be walked. As you
yes.
say, the white horses over here, the Offington white horse and the Cern giant, they're meant to be walked around. And the thing about these glyphs on the landscape, a bit like crop circles, is that when you put any bit of symbolism on the land, it affects the energy of it.
Mm.
You know, whether it's a permanent stone circle or the Cern giant or the white horse, or the Nazca lines, or the Serpent Mound in Ohio, they actually affect the energy, although they're totally man-made.
Yes.
Sacred geometry, even if man-made, on the landscape, will affect the landscape around it, because it's a sacred symbol you're putting on the land, like crop circles.
So it's a bit like a cake mix. It's putting the energies together and producing something a little bit different, so it's like the Trinity?
Yes, it's...
Would you say?
I think the Trinity is a powerful symbol, but it's just about interacting with the landscape. So and putting something on it doesn't matter whether it's permanent or temporary, it will affect the energies on the landscape, like at this stone I'm leaning against and this stone circle here, you know, they amplified the energy that was already here. It's a bit like when the Christians came along, they built a lot of their churches on ancient sacred sites. It wasn't just to Christianize the place, you know, there's a new God in town and you know you'll now worship the one and only. It was to access the energies of those sites, because they knew they were powerful places already.
Would I be right in thinking then that the early Christians that did plant their community gathering places upon the ley lines, upon sacred sites, would I be right in thinking that they had their mystic person who would douse the land, who would be in tune with the energies?
Well, certainly. This is a continuous tradition. Every village would have had its own dowser and wise person when the Christians rolled up. But, of course, the esoteric line of Christianity, of course, is the Knights Templar. You know, all their sites are on powerful places.
Right.
They are the esoteric line of the Knights Templar, just like the Sufi are to Islam today, and the dervishes are. There's always an esoteric line of every religion, like the ascetics of Hinduism and things like that, you know, which hold the deeper wisdom that the general public, probably not even the vicars and bishops, are aware of. You know, they're just dishing out the mainstream dogma. It would have been the Knights Templars or their local equivalent that would have that spotted these power points and thought, right, if we put our church on that site or our chapel, then we can access God, really, of course, because the previous people would have called it the goddess and the sun god. But it doesn't matter what you call it, really. It's a rose by any other name. But yeah, it's the church definitely knew what they were doing when they built sacred sites.
So it wasn't just a smother.
That was part of it. It was a double whammy, really. You get to do both, don't you? You get to overtake the old religion and you get to access the power centres.
Yeah.
And
that definitely happened in Ireland, didn't it? The taking over.
Yeah.
The famous story there.
It happened all over
St. Patrick.
All over Europe, Europe it happened. It's quite a common thing.
We haven't talked about your actual talks. I believe you still do a great deal of talks, because I think you've been doing these talks for quite some time.
Too long, some would say.
Different types of talks. Well, the longevity, I feel, does express the knowledge that you have gained and that you know about. So very worthy of listening to any of your talks. What talks have you got coming up in the near future, Peter?
I'm doing the two talks I'm mainly doing at the moment is Stolen Images, which is about
relating to your book.
Yeah, on the book, and also Dartmoor Mindscapes, which is about the new book. So they're very different, actually. The Stolen Images one is a PowerPoint presentation showing how every Christian symbol you'll see in a church has a pagan origin. Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of the myths as well, you know, the Jesus myth, Mary Magdalene, all that sort of thing, the flood, dragons, you know, they all have a pagan origin. And the Dartmoor book is one that we're excited with at the moment. That's taking people out onto the landscape and getting them to perceive the dreamtime landscape on the wilds of Dartmoor. So they're very different books, but I guess they sort of are related.
All right, come back to the Dartmoor workshops again. I find this particularly fascinating that you're taking people actually onto Dartmoor for like whole weekends or for days at a time. Mm. When people come to you, again, I'm thinking of the listeners, do they need to feel that they have, I mean, your knowledge is immense, and would people feel that if they came to the workshop having not involved themselves in anything alternative or esoteric or shamanism or whatever before, that they would feel like a fish out of water?
No, certainly not, because I've always, I mean, I'm a Brummie, I'm a city lad, I'm not an intellectual, and I was told years ago that my mission is to get people into this that aren't already into it. Mm-hmm. So I'm not preaching to the converted, you know.
So beginners can expect quite an enlightening time.
I hope so, yeah. They'll certainly experience
do they need to be camping comfortable?
No, people can do their own bed and breakfast or youth hostels. We meet every morning, take people out for the day, and then we usually have an evening walk as well on the Saturday night to see the sunset. We had a gorgeous one last year. We walked up after the pub meal last year. We took them to a nearby stone row, so they had to cross a little river, which was an experience, and then they had to go up this stone row, prehistoric stone row, up to the burial mound at the top, surrounded by tours, no cars in sight. And
we've just got a good crowd of people going by at the moment, folks. And we shall just let them go by. Do you know, I've just looked at that stone down there at the end. It looks like a sitting lion.
Well, then it is.
Wow.
That's what you see it as, that's what it is.
Wow, it's a bit shaded in some areas. I just grabbed that. I apologise.
No,
that took me by surprise.
So on the evening, we took them for an evening walk up to the stone circle, and I kind of worked out, being a bit of a nerd, that if we went to this one stone row, the full moon would rise straight out of this burial mound from the end of the stone row. And in true nerd manner, it did. So we're all standing there, aren't we? So the moon is rising out of this ancient cairn on the next hill from this stone row, and everybody was like, wow. And then a buzzard flew across right in front of us, and that's one of my totem animals, and everybody went wow, and several people got it on their camera, didn't they?
Wow.
I've got it at home. Mm. And so it was just kind of to bless us, you know, because the buzzard, the bird of prey, like, they see the bigger picture, they're overseeing everything. And it was just so magical, and you can't get that from a book. You know, it's about being there, you know, and walking the land. Walking is really important. You know, as you're walking the land, you're developing a unique relationship with us. Mm. This is why, you know, when we take 15 people out for our weekends, you know, they'll have 15 different experiences, and each one of those is valid.
Mm.
You know, nobody should say, you've got to experience this, you know, or you should end up at the end of the workshop by doing this, because I don't believe in that at all. Really, because that, if anything, that disempowers people. You know, whatever people experience is their own experience, and it's valid for them.
Mm.
You know, it's a bit like dowsing around Avery. We'd bring people around, dowsing trips around Avery, and they might experience several different things, different levels, and they're all correct. You know,
do you live near Avebury because you feel that this is a particular land that you're connected to? Shall I say, yourself, your soul is connected to, your spirit's connected to particularly?
Yeah, a lot of my work and research was done in Avery, wasn't it? And then the opportunity came along to us to live in Cairn. not far from here. So it was, it kind of all synchronistically happened at the same time.
Mm. Right.
So we thought, yeah, you know. Right. It's,
so you've not drawn yourself here because you said, this is where my heart is, this is where my soul is. It was a shamanic evolving process.
Yeah,
perhaps.
I don't have to realize. I don't have to realize that the site is calling me in for it to be happening. I think the site did. This place did call me.
Call you in.
And yeah.
I've always been to some of your full moon drumming evenings, and I couldn't help thinking that you'd been called maybe other dimensionally to be a guardian of the place. Have you ever thought of yourself as that?
I'm trying not to be as pretentious, actually, to say something
quite
like
grandiose.
That. It is, yeah. But I think the site has. I think the ancestors have used me, and I feel really honoured, actually, because if I wasn't meant to do all this stuff and write this book, it wouldn't have happened.
Mm.
You know, I spent a night up in West Kennet Longborough before I even started writing the book, and I knew I wasn't alone. You know, and
you mean by that
the ancestor spirit, whatever you want to call it.
What did that feel like, actually, as a human
being? Very scary, very scary,
really?
And it was meant to be. So I went out to the entrance, and I looked round, and I'm looking back into this pitch black chamber, and the moon wasn't out. It was a dark night, and then somebody just said to me, I don't know what it was. You know, I just had a realization that the only thing I had to be frightened of, you know, was fear itself. It was my brain was creating all this, and. I felt as if I sort of was being tested a bit, although I don't like the word test, but it's...
Challenged?
I was challenging myself, really. I was seeing how serious was I about this. And I decided to go back into the pitch blackness. And when I did that, it changed. It was then like a womb. It was like welcoming me. It was as if, you know, I'd gone over some threshold. I think if I hadn't gone back into West Kennet that night, if I'd have just walked down the hill and got in the car, I think the books wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't have been allowed to come in
that profound.
To that level. Yeah, the book wouldn't have happened. The book wouldn't have happened. And I think I went through something that night. And we've had similar things happen at Dartmoor. Sometimes you have to step off the ledge, get out your comfort zone. You know, I'm a great believer that knowledge can be withheld as well as given. You know, why should the planet Earth give us anything when you consider what we've done to it? I think you have to, you know, the site, the ancestors, they read your heart, they see your intent, and they can sort out the bullshit. You know, they can see who's there just for ego and to make loads of money and all that sort of thing. And if I didn't feel, let's put it this way, if I didn't feel I was meant to be doing this, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I really mean that. And I'm already gearing down to my retirement, aren't I?
Getting on.
Sue says I'll never retire.
Oh, no.
Why would you give up something that you love doing, I guess? Oh. Yeah.
Can I just check, Peter, in terms of obviously people, this interview might have triggered their interest in visiting ancient sites and stone circles and the like. do you have any advice in terms of how I've heard it described as clearing the channel, how people can connect, obviously, whilst walking around ancient sites or stone circles? I mean, do you have any advice that you give to the people that come on your workshops, you know, before they come on the workshops and walk amongst these ancient sites? Do you recommend that they detox or that they, you know, do certain things? Or have you found that it's just in yourself, it's just become a sort of a natural process for you, really,
you're
connecting?
I generally don't give too much advice before people arrive, do we? We tell them to come with an open mind, really.
Yeah.
And I have found, actually, that the people who come on our workshops, especially the Dartmoor one last year, were exactly the people who were meant to be there.
Right.
Because you won't be attracted to my workshop if it's the wrong thing.
No.
You know, I've never found anybody who shouldn't be there. And the group we had last year, the 13 people we had last year, they were unbelievable. They'd never met each other. They were from all over the country, different sexes, different ages, a couple, mainly single, men, women, lots of men, which I like. There's never enough men on workshops. I'm sure we've all experienced
this. Yes, this is true.
Which is a shame, because men still run all the world's religions, all the governments, all the
economics,
companies.
Economics, politics.
We're not going to change the world by converting all the women. We've got to get the men on board. End of soapbox. So all the people who came last year were all got on along to the so well that to the extent they all insisted they had each other's emails at the end of it. So I think because the way I put it out on the on the website, and that there is walking involved, you know, they might do 5 or 6 miles in one day. It kind of whittles out the people who just want to play with it. You know, the you know, like the village hall workshop. Junkies, that sort of thing. Sorry if I'm offending anybody.
Probably.
So although we don't send them out on a although we don't send them out on a route march, you know, it's mindful walking, slow all down. We stop at one tour, connect with it, have a meditation. We take them into a little cave. We do some drumming. We might be there for an hour, then we go off to a sacred stream.
So it's not like you're not sorry to interrupt. You're not relaying too much information. It's quite a gentle process.
No, the land is relaying the information. We are just the facilitators. The land has got all the wisdom.
Of course.
No. We're just kind of setting up the situation where the land can speak to them. Oh, totally. I'm a great believer in that. There's a whole section in the Dartmoor book where it tells how to walk mindfully and, sorry Sue, you
want to... guiding people to look and observe and to feel and to understand what's going on.
Just slow down. I mean, in modern society, it's just that slowing down.
It is about slowing down, it really is. Yeah, it really is.
And Sue has just spoken, and I'm really, really enjoy if, Sue, you give us some input from your experiences. She's with wide open eyes, oh my goodness. But you're alongside Peter in all of these workshops, in all of the talks, I should imagine, and a collaborator on the books, are you not?
Most definitely, yes.
She's a brilliant proofreader.
I proofread them.
She proofread them.
And I am scrupulous.
Well done. Do you enjoy participating in trekking all over different parts of the country?
I love it, yes.
You love it?
Absolutely thoroughly.
And how long have you been doing this with Peter, if I may ask?
Peter and I have been together for 9 years.
And before that, were you trekking across the country or were you doing other things?
Not so much trekking across the country, but I've always connected with nature and with the land.
Yeah.
It's been so important to me ever since I was a toddler, because my very first memories of being 18 months old, barely walking, but being eye level with flowers and being aware of the bees coming in to feed on the nectar.
Yeah.
And just thinking, wow, isn't this just amazing?
Yeah. And what did you do when you got older after having that connection with nature?
Always having had a love of nature, I've always been out walking, and I did a bit of cycling as well, but just generally, just feeling that it was so important. And I actually got involved with a lot of environmental work. In joining Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth.
Other political parties are available.
And other political parties. Yeah.
But are useless.
They're not political. They're not political.
They're not. No.
just campaigning to save Mother Earth from the pollution and the mess and all the crazy things that humanity is doing that is destroying our beautiful Earth.
And your shiatsu?
Yes, I do shiatsu, yes. Through my own health problems, I then ended up becoming interested in complementary therapies and decided to then train in shiatsu, which was relatively unheard of when I first started training.
Wow, but it's connected, quite well known now.
It connected with me on a soul level.
And please feel free to share your contact details with our listeners if you wish to promote your business.
Yeah, for anyone living in the Wiltshire area, yes.
And how would people contact you for your treatments, for healing?
My email address?
Yes.
I can give out.
If that's okay for you, please.
Is Sue_Wallace. And that's Wallace with an A-C-E at the end, @btopenworld.com.
There's a link from my website though, and you've got your own Facebook page as well, haven't you?
Yeah. Are you? Yeah. Okay. So there you can make the links through. That's good. As I know, shiatsu is a particularly profound healing, isn't it? It takes a lot of study.
It does. Yes. It was 4 years, and even when once I'd qualified, I feel I've still kept on learning with every treatment that I do.
I think the Reiki has helped as well. Actually, I noticed when I did my Reiki 3, which you've had. My sensitivities to the land and dowsing became more acute.
Yeah, some people do say that.
Yeah.
They say it does sharpen your senses.
So there's one piece of advice you should give our listeners, maybe.
You're Reiki master.
Reiki, I'm not a Reiki master, I'm only Reiki 2.
Oh, Reiki 2.
But I already had that sensitivity before I did the Reiki. Mm.
And then again, I feel that about Reiki as well. Sometimes you actually don't need to go through the system of Reiki.
No.
So sometimes it works for some people, sometimes you don't need it, and that's quite an interesting one. But I feel that shiatsu was slower at taking on in this part of the world because it does take quite a bit of study, doesn't it?
Yes, too. It does. Yes.
So it's a very responsible healing system.
Well, they had healing thousands of years ago. We just come in full circle, haven't we?
This process of rediscovery, really. Yeah.
Totally. And when's your first book, Sue?
No pressure.
Well, I've already co-authored one with Peter.
Yeah, so you're going to do your own book soon, aren't you? It's the women we want to bring forward and to be the goddess of our world, don't we?
Peter is encouraging me to write about the springs and the holy wells.
Oh, fascinating.
Wonderful,
because water has really connected with me, and it's the lifeblood of Mother Earth.
Totally. Yes, absolutely, it is, and so many of them are blocked. There's Heidi that's in Southampton with Patrick McManaway looking at what to do about the springs in Southampton. All around, there's a load of them around Southampton that have been blocked for quite a long time, and we understand that that's caused some energy problems within Southampton.
Just to give our listeners some context, that's the area in Hampshire in the UK where Heather and I hail from.
Yeah, Southampton, New Forest, Hampshire. A lot of women are beginning to notice, because they are the goddess wells, aren't they?
Yes.
The feminine, how important they are and how they need to be honoured. Would you say the same thing?
Oh, completely. Yes. Our water has been abused.
Mm. Yeah, yes.
And how are we going to live if we can't drink
Absolutely.
Water?
Somebody said to me yesterday, you can buy something that turns your tap water fizzy. So you carbonate your tap water. I was trying to get my head round that, because I drink spring water, not tap water. And this is a very holistic, organically minded person.
It sounds a bit like, you know, in supermarkets we have the pre-prepared cut carrots and all that sort of, and you know, mashed potato.
And I thought that was, and I said, anyway, how much is this? £50. So I thought that was very odd. But
fizzy water's not good for us anyway, especially the ladies. It weakens our bones.
When we take anything or do anything, we should say, does it occur naturally in nature?
Mm. Yes.
If not, avoid it like the plague, I would say.
Yeah. Patrick, I've been done his course. And
Patrick's good.
Amazing chap too. As well as yourself, Peter, I have to say. I will add that one in, the both of you. But Patrick did say, from his experience, that water, in all its goodness, can also be the most corrosive substance upon this planet. So if you're walking around with bottles of water and it's not a hot day, think about it, because maybe it's not the best thing for your kidneys drinking too much.
The Tao, didn't he? One of the Tao is saying is that the softest element we know of can erode the hardest rocks, which is true. It's the
paradox.
It is, yeah.
Peter, please tell us your website
and your contact details.
My website is stoneseeker.net, stoneseeker.net. Mm-hmm. I've also got a Facebook page where you'll find me. It's facebook.com/stoneseeker again, where you can just search Peter Knight, actually. I think if you do Stone Seeker on Google now, I'm on page one. I've made it to page one.
Yes, I did a search during the week. I can confirm that.
It's taken 10 years, yes. My email address is stoneseeker@waitrose.com.
And have you got any events coming up you'd like to
share? We have, yes. He's trying to think of them now, because he wasn't expecting that question. We've got the Dartmoor. There's a West Kennet Long Barrow evening coming up
when's that, Peter?
Early July. the July full moon. And the first weekend in July, we've got the Dartmoor Mindscape weekend. And we're also doing a different Dartmoor weekend in August. They are both different. They're both standalone events where we go to different sacred sites, different stone circles, walk the landscape. We'll show you the huge faces, the dragons in the land. And
I tell you, I'm absolutely thinking, my God, I've got to do this.
You must come. And no experience required, really. And they really are laid back weekends, but I think hopefully people will find them interesting and profound.
Fantastic. Sue, what is going to be the name of your first book that you're writing alone?
Oh, I don't know.
It's about springs.
It's about springs and holy wells.
Holy wells of this land.
So it's going to be...
Springs and holy wells of this land, perhaps.
Yeah.
My advice to anybody writing a book, get the title...
Yeah, work from there.
Do the cover and the rest follows.
Oh, seriously?
I always do that. Yeah,
because
I'm a very visual person. Get the title and then you're not working on a book. I'm doing my book, but I'm working on... Because by creating a title, you're it's a thought form and you're bringing it into reality.
Mm. Yeah.
Decide on your title and even do the cover of the book while you're still writing it. And
Do you have artists do that, or do you do
it
yourself?
I do all myself.
I
do book designing, if anybody's...
Stone
Seeker
would...
Publishing is looking for other authors who want to publish. The last six books I published myself, and it's the way to go. And with Photoshop people don't need the programs you've got now. You don't need.
I've heard some people saying that actually is a difficult way to go, but it's hard to get published by, ongoing publishers. But you found it is self-publishing is a good way to go.
It's the way to go forward, because it's hard work. But there again, if you're meant to do it, the universe will support you. Why do you think it's going to be easy? But it'll happen if it's meant to happen. Yeah.
Mm. Well, people, I'm sure a lot of you actually want to get a book out there. Get in touch with Peter Knight, and so we look forward to your first book, that standalone first book. And can you tell me which one it is that you co-authored with Peter? Which of the books?
It was The Walks...
Khan, Gateway to Ancient Wiltshire.
Ah, yes.
It's Khan, C-A-L-N-E. And we did a walking book. Khan is just a few miles from Avebury. Mm-hmm. And we did a walking book taking people on little walks around the history of the churches. But two of the walks come to Avebury and go through prehistoric sites. It was just a little walking book we did for our local community a few years ago, and it's gone very well. Yeah.
And as we're joined by the sheep, that seems a nice way to bring things to end. So thank you again, Peter and Sue. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Discerning Consciousness.
My pleasure.
Exciting new development to have such a leading light on the show.
We must do it again sometime, is what I would say.
Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, and thank you so much for doing this. That was absolutely wonderful information, as ever, an absolute library full of knowledge and wisdom and history, and hence looking like your shelves at home, I should imagine.
Yes.
Thank you, Peter.
Right, well, thanks.
Thank
you, everyone, for tuning
in
again. And we're signing off now, and hope you join us again soon. Thank you. Bye.